what bothers me as an historian and a teacher. I teach my students fidelity to the facts, to logic, to impartial analysis. And Donald Trump has just shredded the whole idea of truth, of science, of logic, and evidence.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof.
So, guys, I'm really excited that we're able to bring you this conversation. We tracked down American University professor Alan Lichtman. He's been with the university since 1973. He's an amazing American historian who famously developed the Keys to the White House model, which he created with a Russian seismologist, believe it or not, which uses 13 true or false criteria to predict whether the candidate of an incumbent party will win or lose the next election for the presidency. And it was really interesting because he accurately predicted Trump's win in 2016. So I wanted to talk to him about how one can be a better futurist and what his thoughts are going to be for 2020. So obviously, we want to bring this to you right before the election. Of course, you'll be able to see pretty quickly whether or not he is right or not. Let's jump right into this.
Alan, welcome to Future Proof.
Thank you so much. Happy to be on.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask you just in terms of how you define your work, who are you and what do you do on a day-to-day basis?
Yes, I am the Distinguished Professor of History at American University in Washington, D.C. It's not a title I made up. It's an official title. It's the highest academic rank. There are only four or five of us out of many hundreds in the university. I specialize in modern American political history, social science, and quantitative methods. I've been teaching at American University 46 years, since 1973. Started when I was nine, but that's a whole other story. I do a lot of other things as well. I do a lot of media interviews like this, and I comment on my prediction system, which we'll talk about today for presidential elections, and generally on American politics and history. I've also been an expert witness in more than 100 civil rights cases. And for the United States Commission on Civil Rights, I discovered what really happened in Florida's 2000 presidential election. And I've lectured all over the world, author or co-author of about a dozen books and well over 200 scholarly and popular articles. And I was delighted to be recognized by Rictopia as number 85 out of the world's 100 leading geopolitical experts.
That's pretty big shoes to fill. That's impressive. I definitely wanted to ask you, of course, since we're recording this right before the election, you know, if you could talk a little about the 13 keys and how earthquakes help inform your framework, which I find really interesting.
Yeah. The 13 keys are based upon the insight that American presidential elections are essentially votes up or down on the strength and performance of the party holding the White House. Imagine that. It's governing, not campaigning, that really counts. And I'd love to tell you, I came up with the 13 keys by long and deep contemplation. But if I were to tell you that, to quote the late, not so great Richard Nixon, that would be wrong. I came across the keys and developed them in 1981 when I was a distinguished visiting scholar at Caltech in Pasadena. And there I met the world's leading authority, as you say, on earthquake prediction, Vladimir Kailas Borok, the head of the Institute of Pattern Recognition and Earthquake Prediction in Moscow, and one of a small number of worldwide scientists who are members of both the U.S. and the National Academies of Sciences. And it was his idea that we collaborate. And of course, being foresightful, I said, no, we're not. Earthquakes may be a big deal here in Southern California. I got to go back to Washington, D.C. Nobody cares about earthquakes. And he said, oh, no, I already solved earthquakes. He said, get this. In 1963, he was a member of the Soviet scientific delegation that came to Washington, D.C. and negotiated the most important treaty in the history of the world, nuclear test ban treaty that's kept us from poisoning our planet. And he said he fell in love with politics and indeed always wanted to use the methodology of earthquake prediction to predict elections. But he said, look, I live in the Soviet Union. It's either supreme leader or off with your head. But you're an expert in U.S. politics and the presidency. So we became the odd couple of presidential research. And our key insight was twofold. One, to reconceptualize presidential elections in seismological terms, not as, remember, this is 81, not as Carter versus Reagan, Republican versus Democrat, liberal versus conservative, but as stability, the White House party stays in power, and earthquake, the White House party loses power. And part of that insight was we wanted to focus on the strength and performance of the White House party, not on the campaign or the opposition. So with that insight, we looked at every presidential election from 1860, the horse and buggy days of politics, when Lincoln was elected, to 1980. And using the methods of pattern recognition, we came up with the 13 key factors that could distinguish stability and earthquake, and our simple decision rule. You don't even have to take your shoes off. If six or more of the keys go against the party holding the White House, they are predicted losers.
So I think that there's been quite a bit of conversation around your framework. Is there anything that you think that might be particularly misunderstood about your 13 keys from a layman who's, you know, not really diving into it in that great detail?
Yeah, I think there are two things. One is the notion that the keys are somehow subjective, like I have keys on policy change, scandal, whether or not the incumbent or challenging party are the once in a generation, truly broadly inspirational candidates. I've gotten a lot of criticism of that. And my response is, it's not subjective, it's judgmental. And historians make judgments all the time. You can't reduce human behavior to a number. Moreover, it's not random judgment. Number one, when you buy my book, Predicting the Next President, The Keys to the White House, you'll see that the keys are very carefully defined. It's not a matter of opinion. You can have your own opinion, but if you want to turn a key, you got to stick to my definition. And number two, I've answered these keys. I've turned the keys all the way back to 1860. And so you got a huge record to be consistent with. For example, I don't give Donald Trump the charisma key, and I've taken a lot of heat for that. But I said, look, the definition of the key is you have to be the once in a generation, broadly inspirational candidate, like Franklin Roosevelt, who totally reordered political coalitions, or Ronald Reagan, who brought in all those Reagan Democrats. Trump is a great showman, but he appeals to a narrow slice of the electorate. We've had candidates like that before. Barry Goldwater, who had a fervent conservative following. George McGovern, who had a fervent liberal following. I didn't turn the keys for them, and I don't turn it for Trump. Second thing for which, and by the way, eventually the forecasting world came around to my point of view and realized the keys, which combine judgmental and cut and dried indicators, are an extremely good way to do forecasting. I twice keynoted the International Forecasting Summit and published in all the big forecasting journals and gave papers at the American Political Science Association. So save your bell bottoms. You never know what might come back into style again. Second thing is 2000, a truly impossible election to predict. And I've taken some heat for that, but I think I came as close as you could come to calling that impossible election. I said Al Gore would win the popular vote, and he did. But then the election was stolen in Florida, which Bush won by 537 votes. I proved in my 2001 report to the United States Commission on Civil Rights that tens of thousands of African-American votes, which were 95% Gore, were suppressed. That was followed up by a study by political scientist Walter Mabane, who proved that on a full and fair count, Al Gore should have won Florida by more than 30,000 votes, should have won it going away. So I think I came as close as you can come to predict that election.
Okay, so we're recording this on October 22nd, and I believe releasing on the 28th. As things stand now, like, how are you feeling about the outcome? And according to the, unless I'm mistaken, according to the keys, nothing that anybody does between now and Election Day necessarily can change anything, right? Like, maybe Trump should just go home, relax, recover from COVID, and it's sealed. Or tell me if I'm wrong.
You're absolutely right. The keys are big picture factors. They don't change easily, and they don't change in response to anything the candidate says or does on the campaign trail, not speeches, debates, ads, attacks, dirty tricks. None of that affects the keys. Now, do you want me to explain how I got to my prediction and what it is?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. Now, remember, the way it works is it measures the strength and performance of the White House party. If they lose 6 of the 13, they're predicted losers, and only 2 of the keys have anything to do with the candidates. But as of the end of 2019, Trump was down only 4 keys. When I predicted his election in 2016, I got a note written on a copy of the Washington Post where I made my call, and it said, "Professor, congrats, good call." And in big Sharpie letters, it was signed Donald J. Trump. So he acknowledged my 2016 prediction, but he didn't understand the deeper meaning of the keys, that now that you're the incumbent, you're going to be judged on your record. And instead of dealing substantively with the pandemic and the cries for social and racial justice that hit this year, he went back to his 2016 challenger playbook and thought he could talk his way out of them. Didn't work. He lost 3 more keys. The short-term economy key, measured by an election year recession, the long-term economic key because of the negative growth, and the social unrest key because of what's raging across the land. So he goes from 4 keys down to 7 keys down, 1 more than the 6 needed to predict his defeat. So my final prediction, which I first issued in early August and stand by, is that Donald Trump will become the first sitting president since Bill Clinton beat George H.W. Bush in 1992 to lose re-election. Moreover, never in the history of the United States has the party holding the White House suffered such a sudden and dramatic reversal of fortune in just a matter of a few months. And Trump has no one to blame but himself. He's the president.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And in regards to your system, when you're down by more than 6 keys, if 7 are against you, 8 are against you and whatnot, does that have any implication for the electoral college, such as you might lose by even more, the more keys that are against you?
I'm just predicting winners. I'm no longer predicting it. Ever since we've had these issues between the popular vote and the electoral college, I don't predict popular vote. And there is a rough correlation between the number of keys out and the number of electoral college votes that a candidate would get. But the bottom line is, I make unequivocal predictions. I tell you who's going to win. Unlike compilers of polls like Nate Silver, who give you probabilities, and they're meaningless probabilities because they're no better than the polls. And the polls are just snapshots. So he'll tell you in 2016, there was an overwhelming chance that Hillary Clinton would win. But then when Donald Trump wins, he says, see, I told you there was also a probability that Donald Trump would win. So we can never be wrong. And likewise, never.
The problem with that scenario, I would say, is that if somebody says there's a 16% chance of something happening, it means if you ran that scenario 100 times, it might happen. They might be right. 16. It might fall out that way, 16%, 16 out of 100. But you can't run that same scenario again. So, yeah. So
right.
It's not helpful.
A meaningful probability, right? It's not like the binomial theorem for coin flips.
So I really want to ask you, because I think a lot of our listeners are very much into becoming better forecasters of the future and modeling things accordingly.
Yes.
How do you go about factoring in essentially, when we're talking about presidential elections, every 4 years, you've got a very different situation, a very different electorate. Obviously, this year, you've got mail-in voting and the pandemic. So how do you think about factoring in things like that? Or because obviously, when you developed your 13 keys, you didn't have those as part of your framework because those weren't things that you had to be thinking about then.
Every 4 years, some smart people tell me, look, your keys won't work this year because things are different. We have an African-American running. We have a woman running. We have unprecedented pandemic and a chaotic president in Donald Trump. And my answer is, remember, retrospectively, the keys go all the way back to 1860 and prospectively to 2016 and soon to 2020. So the keys have endured through enormous changes in our society, in our demography, in our politics, in our economics. Back in, obviously, in 1860, we're an agricultural country. Women couldn't vote. Most African Americans couldn't vote. My ancestors from Eastern Europe were even here yet. We had very different rules. No personal registration, no secret ballots, no computers, no polls, no cars, not even radios. So the keys can endure through changes from 1860 to 2016. They can endure through the changes this year or any other year. Does that mean that the keys will endure indefinitely into the future? I can't say that. But so far, I've had a pretty good 40-year run.
And I think that you bring up a really important point, which is it's a matter of the benefit of when you're trying to forecast the future of actually being a historian and diving into some historical context and looking back to the 1860s to see if you're building a model, does it bear out when you look at enough data historically?
Yeah, and here's why the model bears out through such enormous changes, because basically what hasn't changed is the pragmatic nature of the electorate. Going all the way back to Lincoln, makes a rational, pragmatic decision about whether or not the party holding the White House should get another term. I sometimes call this the Joe the Plumber theory, after that obnoxious guy who asked Barack Obama all those nasty questions in 2008. So you hire Joe the Plumber to fix your pipes. And if he floods your basement, you're not going to hire him again. But if he does a good job, charges you a reasonable price, you will hire him again. That sounds simplistic, but that's the basic idea. And then all of the details are in the 13 keys.
Obviously, I would say something like the 13 keys can be helpful in any way in predicting what happens if somebody, let's say, loses an election and doesn't concede, hypothetically. How do you wrap your head around predicting what happens in a situation like that, a unique once-in-a-lifetime situation that you haven't necessarily developed some framework for? What's your thought process like for wrapping your head around things like that?
This is a post-election question, so it's outside parameters of the
of
keys.
Course.
But I've thought about it quite a bit. First of all, people don't understand. Donald Trump does not have to concede. He does not have to accept the results of the election. Once the Electoral College votes are counted in December, and if Joe Biden gets a majority, he becomes president on January 20th, 2021. Despite all of Donald Trump's tears, it doesn't matter one bit. I have no doubt Donald Trump will go to his grave claiming, no matter what, he was really cheated out of the election and he should have won. Look, in 2016, he lost the popular vote by 2.8, 2.9 million votes, but he claims he really won the popular vote because 3 to 5 million illegal voters materialized out of the sky on election day, all voted for Hillary Clinton, and equally mysteriously disappeared. What nonsense, but he's been mongering that for years. Do I think he's going to barricade himself in the White House and call on the Proud Boys and the Boogaloo Boys to keep him in office? No. Donald Trump's a coward. He blusters a lot, but he's a coward. He can't even fire people by looking them in the eye. He's got to fire them by tweet or have someone else do it. He's not going to put up a fight. He'll claim he won. He'll try to keep his loyal base, and he'll try to make money through that by maybe setting up his own cable or television network.
So just to switch gears for a second, because I know obviously you probably are in the news most often now for this specific bit of work, but I think there's probably a lot more to your work. What are some areas that you're focused on right now, aside from general election results?
Yeah, I'm working on a new book, and here is something that I really want to bring home to your listeners, because it's been nowhere near as completely covered as it should be. Our planet is on the ballot in this election. Catastrophic climate change is not a theory. It's here. The West Coast is burning up. The South has record heat. Southwest has record heat and drought. There are derechos ravaging the Midwest. Record storms are hitting our Gulf Coast. Miami floods when it's not even raining. And it's going to get much worse. Our coastal cities are going to be underwater. We're going to have tens of millions of migrants stalking the land. Our crops are going to burn up. And Donald Trump is a climate change denier. He not only has stopped efforts to combat climate change, he's throttled them back. He's pushed us in reverse. Our family is a climate change activist family. My wife heads the only PAC, voteclimatepac.org, dedicated to electing members of Congress and the Senate who will fight to control climate change. And her organization puts out a voter's guide, which deals with challengers, not just incumbents, open seat candidates. It's a way in which you can vote climate, and you've got to vote climate, or it's going to be catastrophic for our planet. We cannot endure four more years of going backwards on this, and nothing can be more important. The other thing I'm working on is the threat to our democracy, working on a book about remaking democracy after Trump, because he doesn't cozy up to autocrats like Putin. He wants to be one. He said Article 2, falsely, of course, lets him do anything he wants. He's assaulted the free press, an essential pillar of democracy. He's politicized justice and every other department and agency of government. He's destroyed checks and balances by stonewalling all attempts at oversight. He has purged the government of inspectors general, of sort of anyone in his administration who'll be critical of him. I don't know if our democracy would take four more years of that.
Yeah, there's a, I think, and I'm paraphrasing, but I've heard from a few people smarter than me, that if you have somebody who is a little bit less inept, but who has the same type of autocratic tendencies, and you've established this type of precedent or this type of norm, imagine what somebody else could do. So it's a matter of trying to strengthen things to ensure that we don't head in that direction.
It's very frightening, and it's real. It's not hyperbole. You can see these actions every single day, not to mention what bothers me as an historian and a teacher. I teach my students fidelity to the facts, to logic, to impartial analysis. And Donald Trump has just shredded the whole idea of truth, of science, of logic, and evidence. He just makes things up that he thinks will serve him at the moment. And if you don't have truth, you don't have freedom and you don't have democracy.
A lot of ways, I think that trying to predict what's to come is the pursuit of truth and figuring out what's going to happen and not necessarily what you want to happen, but just let's look to see, like, objectively where are things going. And when you yourself get something wrong, what's your process for reviewing everything to do a better job next time? Is there some type of postmortem or some type of formal reflection that you do?
Always. And before I get to that, I want to follow up on your point about prediction, because prediction can also yield proposals, ideas for making our democracy better. So if you believe the keys, and I think you should, of course, then conventional campaigning makes absolutely no difference and should be abandoned. Instead, if we were campaigning by the keys, we would get rid of the sound bites, the attack strategies, the dirty tricks, the negative ads, and instead we would campaign to build a mandate for governing, since you win by governing well. And so candidates would give us their vision. What bills would they introduce in their first 100 days specifically? What executive orders? What kinds of people would they put in their cabinet, in the White House, on the judiciary? That way you would govern better and give your party a better chance to win. So it's positive. And even if you lost, at least you would have made your mark. You would have said something important. Who remembers anything recent losing candidates have said other than gaffes? McCain, Kerry, Romney, Gore, nobody remembers anything they have said. So we could have a whole different kind of politics. And I've been screaming about this for years. The other point, of course, I reevaluate. The big reevaluation was this. I no longer predict the popular vote because we now have a disconnect between the popular vote and the Electoral College that we didn't previously have. When I first developed my system, you had to go all the way back to 1888 to find a divergence. Now there is a built-in divergence. People don't realize this. The Democrats can count on 5 to 6 million extra popular votes in just two states. And you know what they are, New York and California. Those votes count for essentially nothing in the Electoral College. Democrats could win those states by 537 votes, like Bush won Florida in 2000, and still get all the Electoral College votes. So that means in any close election, Democrats are going to win the popular vote, even though they may not win the Electoral College. So the baseline that I originally adopted has shifted. So now in 2016 and 2020, I only pick winners.
And I think that's a perfect transition to my last question is, for somebody who wants to be a winner in terms of being a better predictor of the future on an ongoing basis, how do they start wrapping their head around a problem? What would you advise them to do in
Yes.
terms of getting better at that?
Yeah. My first and most important piece of advice is the most critical thing to be a successful forecast. It's not knowing math, although you got to know math. It's not knowing history, although you got to know history. It's not knowing politics, although you got to know history, politics, or whatever realm you're dealing with. The most important thing is putting aside your own personal views. If you let your personal opinions taint your predictions or your prediction model, you are useless as a forecaster. And for me, going into this year, so far I've picked 4 Republicans and 5 Democrats. That is about as even-handed as you can get. Second thing I would advise you, don't get too complicated. If I was trying to call elections by looking at what's going on with each individual voter, even what's going on with voter groups, I'd make errors. It's too complicated to analyze in that way. So another secret behind the keys is we reduce the problem to simple integral parameters, which are the 13 keys. It's like you put a sugar in a cup of tea. You're not going to figure anything out by trying to follow each sugar molecule. You can measure the overall sweetness or the heat. You can pretty much understand what's going on in your cup of tea with simple integral parameters. And the final thing, keep in mind history. A lot of forecasters don't look very far back into the past, and that's why their models are very fragile. The more you take into account history, the more robust your model. So yeah. Now I've taught everybody how to supersede me and make me obsolete.
You know what? Everybody's building off of the backs of the giants that came before them in some ways. So you're allowing people to do that. But no, I think that this will be very helpful for people to at least have even a fraction of the success that you've had in a very important area and just a few more days to go to see if you're correct. I think there are probably a good chunk of the country that's hoping that you are. Let's just leave it at that. And Alan, thanks so much for making the time.
Jeremy, it was a real pleasure. I have to tell you, doing this for 40 years, I make half the country really mad at me every 4 years. And now the whole country can be really mad at me.
Amen.
Thanks again to Alan Lichtman for making the time in his busy schedule. I am just probably one of the many people listening to this right now who's very anxiously awaiting this political season to be over and to see who wins and figure out whether or not I've got to move to another country or not. But if you like what you just heard and this is your first time here, be sure to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Stitcher, the choice is yours. And if you're a longtime listener, please remember to rate and review Future Proof, as that's the number one way we get the show in front of people just like you. Special thanks this week to associate producers Jason Stack and V. Cortuccio, and assistant producers Aaron Cohen and Michelle Portnoy. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.